something effect that is found is what is called the Shit Rabbeinu Gershom or Hagola. Although whether that is in fact the Shit Rabbeinu Gershom or it is not the Rabbeinu Gershom or Hagola put out a collection of tshuvot under his own name. I think this is a construction.
It might have just been taken from the Maharam,
selected from the Maharam, but the Maharam exists in many different versions. So, tough to know. So we have it with...
Can you put it out?
Don't remember.
I don't know if it's like a sefer.
I don't think there was a Shu'at Rabbeinu Gershom Aragola. I think that it's a constructed thing. If people have lots of manuscripts, which seem to...
Bar-Ilan constructed, or like someone actually constructed it?
I don't think Bar-Ilan ever constructs things itself.
I think they do.
Okay, there we go.
Is she the university?
Right. Yeah.
Okay. So I.
Bar-Ilan renumbered. I think it's read H by themselves.
Okay.
After Mosarov Cook renumbered it, after someone else had renumbered it.
Okay. So I take no position as to the antiquity or attribution of this, but somewhere in Ashkenaz, at least one person addressed this case, and possibly two. All right, that's about what I know. The case is there's a Reuven who has a Marufya of Komrim, right? So he has some kind of monastery or abbey. That is his Marufya, where he functions fundamentally, as their financial agent, which is a big one. Right, this isn't just any individual non-Jew. Right, he's got a whole collection. Reuven's a tzurva mirabbananhu, right? Reuven's a young scholar. Melamei Torah l'rabim bechinam, and he teaches Torah for free. V'ikru talmidav berevach shem arviach marufya shelo v'nichdusu l'hafsido. It's like one of these great starting the stories that are so nicely, right? He's teaching Torah for free, and his students recognize marufya, and their first reaction is, let's steal it from him. It must not have been. I don't know what Torah he was teaching, but
maybe
he taught this sugya too honestly. I don't know. It's not a happy opening.
It's like Shakespearean tragedy.
I don't know, or the onion. I'm not sure which. Okay, he teaches Rabbim, but apparently he has identifiable talmidim, and he complains about his students to the community as a whole, and there seems to be a consensus according to this tshuva. Everybody says those talmidim, they're bad, and so everybody agreed that they would be in harem if they kept on trying to go for that marufya. But now the problem is that means that now everybody knows that there is this marufya that this guy has, which is quite lucrative, and so in the process of announcing to the whole community, by the way, we're putting these talmidim in harem for stealing it. They also put a big sign saying business opportunity. Yes, yes.
None of that matters. You're assuming Talmidim means like in Torah?
Or what else?
I think the business people he trained.
No, I don't think so. He's a servant of Rabbanan. He's Lamed Torah L'Rabban Bechinam. It's no gain to the question, because the whole point is everyone's gonna agree that his Talmidim are under his authority because he's the Rav, so they can be put in Chirim on his authority. The problem is everyone else.
Right.
But his business tell me they aren't under his halachic authority.
I think that's the point.
Now, why would his business...
your apprentice can't throw you out of the market once you finish training him.
An apprentice isn't the same thing as a student. These are very clearly his students.
Yeah, I don't think that's... I go with Dina. I don't think it's a... I don't see any hint of...
Why isn't everyone just telling me to him?
So that is a good. I think that he has a klaus. I think that he has a yeshiva. I think we'll go through it. That's what I think. Yes, Ellie.
I wonder if it's enough to mean that if he gets paid for his teaching or not.
No, it says bechinam.
No, I understand that. But so does that mean that if you be paid for it, you wouldn't have the ability to fight back?
If you were paid for there are two questions here. Actually, one question is going to be the general question of whether. Of whether you have a right to exclusivity on a relationship you establish with non-Jews. And the second question is whether your status as a Torah scholar entitles you to advantages in the community. And that's on the presumption that you're not being paid for being a Torah scholar.
Well,
if you're paid.
I mean, perhaps you're getting paid by the line up. And you have to supplement that income with
So you can imagine somebody creating that structure, but I think the presumption in that universe is that we support Talmidei Chachamim indirectly instead of directly, and they're not paying Talmidei Chachamim their income directly. I think that's the presumption. If you charge for it, we could play that question, but I think that the presumption of this question is he's not charging for it. And that right, and that creates an obligation on the community. Otherwise, we just say the obligation of the community is to give him money.
But also, precisely because it's indirect,
yeah.
It seems that they may have accidentally given him a very large financial windfall.
Well, it's not clear they gave him. It's not clear so far they gave him anything. He may have actually gone out on his own. Maybe he wandered in someday and had a question about biblical grammar. And right, and because of the conversation, they said, "Oh, that's really cool. Why don't you serve as our financial agent?" We don't know how that relationship started. Maybe he inherited it. Although that seems unlikely.
This won't make him notice that he's...
And he's making a lot of money.
Yeah.
Yes. Hikiru berevach shemarviach b'maruf yashal. Well, it is, I mean, it's a maruf yashal komrim. It's not one person. But he has it for many years. Right? And very likely he's a scholar and he built up some kind of relationship with... Right, that it's a scholarly monastery, and they build a relationship. That seems very reasonable that they would do that. Yes, Tina?
Yes.
No. Okay. So he says the first question: Mitoch she'elatchem yesh l'lmod she'ein no'agim imkomchem din marufya. Okay, so we're still in this world, as we saw in the Mordechai, that marufya is a geographic divide, and the description of marufya is no'agim or not no'agim. And so in this verse of the Teshuva, it says, from your question, it seems clear that you don't have a concept of Marufya, because if you had a concept of Marufya, this wouldn't be a Shaila. And who would care that this is a Rabbanan? It's a Marufya, you don't, right? No one interferes with Marufya, yes.
So what does it mean when someone says Shaila Marufya? Does he mean?
It means that he had a relationship which the non-Jews related to him as their financial agent. The Marufya is a relationship that is recognized in the secular world. Mm-hmm. The question is whether Halakha... Right, sees it as a barrier to entry.
Oh, so
it's
a secular term.
Yes, Marufia, I think, right, we'll say, right, I think, well, it is a Latin term, not a...
It's
Arabic. Arabic, okay, yes.
Well,
But I don't think it, it's not coming out of the terms of halakha, right? This is a relationship that exists in the secular world, and the question is whether Jews see it as a relationship that you can poach on or can't poach on.
So, do the Arabs have this concept, or is it...
I don't know. Yes?
Is it a question of something that you can or cannot prosecute in like secular courts?
Not a prosecute. There's no... It's the...
It's not a commercial license. It's not. It's more like some...
No, because the non-Jews can change it whenever they want. The non-Jews are not bound to the Jews,
okay.
Just the Jews are bound, right, just the question of the Jews are bound not to interfere with fellow Jews.
Perhaps it is
what is the point of Marufia? What does it mean when he says Hayal Marufia?
It means that he has established a relationship in which the non-Jews have, at least for the time, given him exclusive access. Right, they've signed an exclusive with him as their financial agent.
But they haven't signed anything. And it's not clear if this is like a verbal agreement or just a standing agreement. Like
it doesn't matter. It can be signed, but it's an at-will contract from their perspective.
That they can terminate any time.
They can terminate whatever they want.
But they can't. But the Jew can't terminate any time.
The Jew can terminate. Why would he want to? Right? He wants the money. The question is whether other Jews can try and steal it.
I'm just like not clear on how important this is. Does that mean that he's come to him three times and now the halacha sees him as a chazaka, he's going to come to him again?
No, it means that there were places where they decided that Jews should not compete with each other for these things.
Okay, fine. So it's already assumed that there is some sort of agreement in this way.
There is an agreement, but we know.
So how can it be that place doesn't...
Does it use the same word to refer to agreements between this Jew and the non-Jews and among the Jews?
Yes. Right. Everyone knows there is a thing called a marufia. There are different machlokas of whether there's a din marufia.
Okay.
Right. Everyone understands the relationship exists, but where the places where they're done din marufia, Jews will not interfere with other Jews, and the places where they're not din marufia, we say, okay, he's your marufia now. He'll be my marufia tomorrow.
And then, like as a metaphor, it'd be like saying that like we recognize that everywhere there's an idea of the green monopolies, but in some places there's antitrust law.
Okay. Well, that's the inverse, right?
Yes.
Yes,
right.
So the secular law is not enforceable?
There is no secular law issue here. The secular law doesn't enforce the exclusive. The secular law just, all that's going on is secularly, the Jew and the non-Jew have this relationship, which either of them can end if they want. Right? It's another Jew who wants to come in and take over the place of the first Jew. That's our issue. The secular law has no ban on that. Not a recording relationship. It is a relationship. Probably they have obligations towards each other. There might very well be fiduciary responsibilities. Right? They're talking about all the terms of the contract. If you're a money lending, if you're someone, you're handling someone's loan, so there's going to be terms for how you can handle that. But that's not related to the interference issue. The interference issue is purely a halakhic issue. And if you want to the conceptualization, right? So the issue. The issue is, this is a very easy case in which whatever benefits there are of competition, right, are going to go outside the community, right? Because once a Jew establishes a relationship with a non-Jew, that non-Jew's money is coming into the Jewish community, right? So we as a community gain nothing from competition. The only thing that will be gained from competition is that the non-Jew saves money. And not only that, we have our energy wasted because potentially there are lots of non-Jews out there and each of them could have established a marufi relationship with the Jew and we could bring all their money to the community. Right? So allowing competition has no direct economic benefit to the Jewish community. Possibly it harms the Jewish community economically, directly, and indirectly it's inefficient because it means that Jews are spending money competing with each other for money that is already guaranteed to come into the community, as opposed to seeking out new business.
How do you know it's guaranteed to come to the community?
Because he has a relationship.
And there no one else could be a money lender, for example. That's guaranteed to come into the community.
Doesn't matter, right?
Like,
he has a relationship.
How did Jews handle the monopoly?
That is a fair question, right? How do Jews handle the relationship with non-Jews? And it may very well be that at some point, if it turned out that Jews were charging much higher interest rates because they had no competition, that the secular government might have discovered antitrust law. But as of now, so far as we know, there is no external regulation on the. There are regulations about rates of interest, right? There are usury laws often. And then there's always pogroms if you think that rates are really, really high. But the question of whether there will be competition among Jewish moneylenders once the relationship has been established. There's ongoing competition until the relationship has been established. And as, you know, with any other thing, a non-Jew could start out having relationship with several people before they establish the Marufi relationship. But once a Marufi relationship has been established, I think it's fair to say that there is no Jewish communal interest in permitting competition. However, there are reasons that you might feel that there is a need for economic mobility in your community, and competition is a way to do that, or you might just think it's wrong to restrain competition.
Or you might have a particular person who you prefer to be in the relationship with.
Or as a community, you might prefer someone else.
Who's getting that and it doesn't give very much to that guy.
Yes, you might have biases towards somebody. So I don't know, but I think that. This is one of the cases where it's very, very rational, and that's the broad point I want to make, is that the advantages of competition as a given, even if you take them in very, very strong terms, only apply if you control all aspects of the economy. Right? But for the monopolists, for the monopolists, having a monopoly is an advantage. And in this case, essentially, the Jewish community is already a monopolist. And regarding this monastery, and so it has no reason to encourage competition. Okay, so we're living in a world, however, right, in which he says the fact that they're asking the question demonstrates that in their community, competition with an existing Marufi relationship, right, you were allowed to solicit non-Jews who already were in a Marufi relationship, and therefore he says. So even if this guy comes along and says, "Well, hey, I want them, right? I like Marufi. I'm convinced, right? I would be Don Marufi everywhere. So what? Even if he says he came from a place where they Don Marufi, we don't care. There's a community. This community does not have the Din Marufya. So that's out. So the rest of the Tshuva works on the premise that we, right, that this is not, right, that this is not a place where the formal Din of Marufya comes in. But here's going to be the underlying question. What is the basis of the distinction between the places where they're done Din Marufya or not? Is this a policy choice, right, as to whether to make a decree, or is it a historical choice that in some places there was such a decree and in some places there wasn't such a decree, or is it a legal conflict which is decided differently in different places? Okay, well, another way of framing it is you always have to distinguish when people use the term minhag between minhag and minhag hapsak. Right? A minhag is a difference that is purely one of practice, whereas a minhag hapsak is we both recognize that there are two legitimate legal opinions and our custom is to follow this one. So the question is whether the places where they're not done din marufya, is that a decision about how to practice which is unrelated to an underlying intellectual halachic dispute? Or is it that there is an underlying intellectual halachic dispute and some people decided this way and some people decided that way? Right? The first way, the only grounds for debating, right, are policy and history. The second way, we can quote texts. Right, so that's right. Right, so the Shur of Enegersha Maragola has now claimed that we are in a space where they are not din, where they are not done din marufya. The question is, does that mean that certain kinds of halachic arguments are forestalled because we have a, by being in such a place we have said we are in a space where we rule against that position, or does he just say so that technicality is off the table? You can't claim that we made a decree. But now we go back to law. And the law is completely open. Yes, Avino.
Could it be, and this is, I sort of saw this, I guess, in, as a possible reading of the Ramal later on, but like, could it be that you have a, you have places where there is an idea of Marufia, you have places where you don't, and in the places where you do, then it's sort of like a tree where it splits off again. Within Marufia, then there are people who are done Marufia the Isser, and there's some who are done the Hetter.
What would it mean to be done Marufia Leheter?
Meaning there is a, I say yeah. This I meaning there's certain towns where they call this sort of relation Marufia.
Yeah.
Within I call it Marufia and it's also I call it Marufia and it's.
No, I don't. I, that's what I'm arguing. I think to be done din Marufia is to claim that there is a rule
it's
against.
It's also.
Yes.
Okay.
I think that's what I'm trying to establish those terms. Right? Marufia exists everywhere. Right, but the question is whether we're done, and then the question is.
No, I mean it the other way. Marufia doesn't exist everywhere. Where it exists, some people disagree.
Right, so that's what I'm saying. I don't think that's true.
Okay.
I think that Marufia, right, everyone understands that such relationships exist. The question is whether they.
Legally enforceable.
Again, legally enforceable. Marufia exists in terms of relations between the Jew and the non-Jew. The question is whether the Jew can enforce within the Jewish community a ban on other Jews trying to intervene with that relationship. Right, that's the only question. And the question that I'm raising then is, right, is this question whether the Jew can or can't, a debate which is rooted in Talmudic interpretation, right, and questions of how to understand what the halacha is? Or is it, no, we all grant that halachically, at least under some circumstances, there is no ban to Marufia, but some places think that after the Gemara, we created a new legislation to ban interfering with the Marufia. All right, I think those are the options. But then, so now we have to reverse it, because so now, when the, so that my point is that when the, when somebody tells you we are in a space where they're not done din Marufia, the question is, does that person therefore have to say, oh, so we have to adopt this side of the Machloket in the Gemara, because if we adopted that side, that would be done din Marufia? Or is he saying, all that means is we didn't make this legislation, so now we're back to the Gemara. Okay, now we have to figure out, right? Because just because there's no Din Marufia doesn't mean that there won't be other restraints on competition that apply to this Marufia. Right? The fact that there was a Din Marufia, if you think that the Marufia is a later legislation, then there must be at least one case left out by the Gemara in which competition with the Marufia is possible, right? That's true, right? That if you separate them, if you say it's legislative, then there must be, then you cannot interpret the Gemara in such a way that it would never be possible to compete with a Marufia. Or for a Marufia is better than compete with a Marufia. Okay. So, Rene Gershom says, okay, so I've told you that we cannot impose the minhag of din Marufia on other people. But now he says, you know what, but maybe I don't need any din of Marufia. Or maybe he says, maybe, or alternatively, you can read him as saying, but the position that you're not done din, you might argue the position that you're not done din Marufia is simply incorrect, because it seems like we have a Gemara in which Rav Huna says, Hai bar mavoa de uki rechaye, v'aser bar mavoa v'kamuki gabe, dinahu de ma'akev le, de amar le kapasakta l'chiyusoy. So his initial, the Havamina, which he tells you is going to be wrong, right? But the Havamina he's working with is that you would be able to aser competition for a Marufia on the grounds of Rav Huna. Now that's odd, because Rav Huna has a very specific framework, which is a geographic limit. Everyone says, right, you have a mavoi. Hai bar mavoa.
Yeah, but
didn't we say the different versions?
But he has the text mavoa, yeah. The different versions I think are more in Rahuna Bridge of Yeshua than Rahuna. So what he's doing is he's abstracting this because a Marufia is not a geographic phenomenon. Right? They have their monastery over there, and I'm over here. And no one said that he's trying to restrict the competition of his Talmidim because they happen to live in his Mavoi, and they do live in the same city. Okay, yes, Jen?
I see what you're saying, and I feel like it would be applicable if we were talking about someone coming in from a different community and trying to take over the business, but I don't really have a problem with expanding Mavoi to the city in this case because it seems applicable. You know what I mean? Like,
okay, you can do it. It's very far from obvious.
I mean, why? No, if the operative words are demar lei kapasavli achiyosai, so who cares?
Who says those are the opposite?
Who says those are the operative words? Who says those always win? Right? Does that mean that you?
Well, no, they don't always win. But Rav Huna thought they always won. What's the point?
Did he think they always won, or do you think they won in the case of somebody else in your mavoi?
He's assuming Rav Huna always thought
that. Right. So that's a big thing, right? So this the assumption of this truva is that the proper way to interpret Rav Huna is that Rav Huna means that there is an absolute barrier to interfering with someone else's livelihood. Right, it's unrelated to geography.
Unless you expand the voice in the community.
Okay, but that's hard in terms of later the Gemara with Rav Huna Bar Yehoshua. But I'm open to that. He's going to reject this, but it's far from obvious that it even gets off the ground.
Couldn't we be medayek that this...
That what? Why?
Unless you assume that both stores are on the same...
Yes. Unless you assume that both stores are on the same thing. But okay, I'm open to it. Yes, Joshua.
I'm just thinking, how could this be anything other than a minhag psak? In the sense that we're talking about what happens when party A takes party B to Beit Din, how does Beit Din respond?
But it may be that...
Beit Din has the minhag psak of there's a din with Marufia, then that's the minhag.
So, Beit Din could have a Kabbalah that this city has made, right? This city has passed the Marufia Act.
At
least,
I mean, it's
that. So, no, we say that a Cherem Yishuv. Some places have a Cherem Yishuv, some places don't have a Cherem Yishuv. Why can't we say some places have Marufia and some places don't have a Marufia? Doesn't bother me. Okay. But he said, but all this is wrong, right? Because less hilchasik Rav Huna, because we rejected Rav Huna on the basis of the braita of Ose Adam Chanut B'tzai Chanutosh Chavero. And then he says, but the Gemara went on and said, Rav Huna is a machlokas tanoim, and he's following Rav Shim Ben Gamliel, right? But the halacha is like the Tanakama. Okay, so far we've just gone through the Gemara. He says, you might think Rav Huna creates an automatic din marufia. We don't paskin like Rav Huna. Okay, but then he goes on and he says, "V'hani mili b'malkim shelo nahagu, avol b'malkim shenahagu hakol kamina kamedina." So again, we have the ambiguity. Does this mean that we paskin against Rav Huna, that's only in places that don't have the minhag, but where they paskin like Rav Huna, we do have the minhag that way? Or more likely, it seems to me, what he's saying is that the halacha is against Rav Huna. There is no automatic decree, but there are places where they had the minhag to paskin a din marufia anyway, even though they would not paskin like Rav Huna about anything but a marufia. Right? That's what I wanted the point I want to make. Right, Rav Huna has implications for many non-Marufia relationships. Rav Huna has relationship for Rav Huna fundamentally is dealing with relationships among Jews. Right, so he tells you the halacha is against Rav Huna, but some places have the custom of paskining as if Rav Huna were correct in the specific context of Marufia.
Wait.
Yeah.
I don't see why you're putting in the words have the custom of paskining like Rav Huna.
I don't need that. I have a custom of ruling as if we paskin like Rav Huna is good. I put as many as ifs you want.
We have a custom of following Marufia.
Okay, good. Fine.
I don't see why we need to go
up. Fine. Okay, so now at this point, what he said is, right, he's just been very careful to say that while I am not going to enforce the law of Marufia in this case, other cities which do enforce the din of Marufia, they're perfectly legitimate. That's what the purpose of the Tribune at such point has been. Is he's trying to avoid ruling Marufia in this case, and at the same time he doesn't want anybody to take his tshuva to a different town and permit competition there. Right? Because he's telling you Marufia is entirely a question of custom. Then he gets to this case. Right? Now he says, well, but tshuva mirabanan, right? But what about a tshuva mirabanan? So now he starts having fun quoting all the stuff about special stuff you do for a tzurva mirabanan, right? He quotes all our stories about a tzurva mirabanan, and he reaches, right, 5 lines to the bottom, he reaches an astonishing conclusion. Mikol tamim elu, yesh lilmod, shetzrichin hakahal lasot takana l'talmid chacham zeh, shemelachto shemayim amelamed torah l'rabim mechinam, kedesh li yitored mitalmudo, v'yigzeru al kol yisrael sheyifreshu bimaruf yishalo, v'yikablu schar al kach. So his psak is, I'll tell you, what's his psak? Avi, what's his psak? That what?
Here he has rights.
Has rights.
Yeah. Here he's special.
Here he's special.
He should be special.
And so when he asks for enforcement, is he asking for enforcement of the existing law? Right. What's the ruling? Right. The psak didn't write the case. Comes to court. They try to seal his marufia. He sues for a restraining order. And right, he sues for a restraining order. And the rabbi in question says that, yes, Supreme Akha.
Issue the restraining order.
Why?
Because it's a temporary abundance, so we can be done with two abundances.
Right, he basically makes up the law. That's what I get, right? Because he could have said, you know what? Allow competition on the Marufia and give him a salary. He could have said, allow competition for the Marufia, but if he loses, make sure that you let him open a dry goods store.
Why is this new? He puts every source to say to make as a special deed.
Right.
And then he uses the language of you should make a special tachar.
Does it tell me?
Is it a real new law, or is it you should follow this precedent? It sounds like you should.
Is there any precedent that when a talmid chacham is in the business, you should, right? You should give him permanent immunity from competition.
You have to let him sell first, only afterwards.
Okay, so you want to claim is that. So we have, right? Rav Dimi is a one shot case.
He could come back a week later.
Rav Dimi is just a story about showing an example of a case that.
Okay, so you all buy it. I thought it was wild. Yes, ma'am. Yeah, and the Loki Hilchasa, right? We had all those different interpretations, right, of what the Loki Hilchasa means.
If this is really Rabbinic Gershom, so we know which interpretation it is.
If it's the same Rabbinic Gershom as the Perish Rabbinic Gershom, yeah. Perish Rabbinic Gershom
probably is Talmudic.
I'm not counting on it.
But let's go.
Yes, Abby.
I actually disagree with your formatting according to your rules. I don't see, like, he brings a whole load of sources to say Tzorbe Barabach is special.
Uh-huh.
Why are you so surprised that he has done the Marufia, essentially, in this case?
He's not done the Marufia.
He's essentially done the Marufia. He says everybody else should stay away from his Marufia.
Yeah, but what he's done it not because of Marufia, he's done it because he's a Tzurva Merabana. Meaning, he doesn't say that you now need to set up One approach would have been, you don't have Marufia, but you should have Marufia now for everybody. He's not saying that. He's saying only Marufia for this guy because of the Talmud.
Right. Yes, so here he says, Dan Din Marufia, Mi Din Talmud Chacham.
Yeah.
Yes.
So Lom Shemet, why is
but
that
only
because
so he has a concept of Marufia.
Yeah, so what he's doing, right, so a way frankly he's doing is he's saying that the Gemara tells us that basically we give Talmidei Chachamim all the advantages that we might give, that anybody might ever have in the marketplace.
Right.
And a Marufia is a concept, and we don't have it here, but it does exist, so let's give it to a Talmid Chacham.
Right.
It seems like he claimed it.
Yes, the other person tried to claim, but the other person didn't claim it on the grounds of the Talmid Chacham. The other person claimed it on the grounds that it was his Marufia,
right.
And he right and those are and he claimed it against his Talmidim,
mm-hmm.
on the grounds of Talmud Chacham.
But he's claiming it now against everybody. Also.
But right, but he tried to do it midin Marufia, and the Tshuva says no, you don't get it midin Marufia. You get it because we're gonna give a Talmud Chacham. Right, a din Marufia.
I don't see what's so surprising.
That's fine. You say so. Can this Talmud Chacham legitimately claim Din Marufia? So it's like, he can't legitimately claim Din Marufia from Minhag, but he can legitimately claim
yes.
Din Marufia
okay,
from
this
Talmud
doesn't surprise you.
Why does it surprise you?
Because I guess that I haven't quite assimilated really being part of the power structure, and therefore it still seems to me that if I went to court and I was suing somebody else, and the judge said, well, that somebody else is kind of like me, so he wins. I would be upset.
But why didn't it upset you 3 Makoros ago?
So I think that it's I think that when you have rules written down,
yeah,
right. So that's part of the right. The marketplace can account for them. But here there is no rule. So if you reframe the rule, the Talmid Chacham, the rules are Talmid Chacham wins.
Yeah,
that's fine. That doesn't sound like a good rule to me.
But it's not just. Well, this is a completely different situation. Like. It's a basketball game, and it's a tie, and like, oh, give it to the Talmidim.
Tie goes to the Talmid Chacham,
like,
yes.
It's a monopoly, which is a very similar, or it's like an established...
Okay, you think it's not a big extension.
Yeah.
You think it's not a big extension.
And also, wasn't it just a rule being stated the first time it came up also? Where was it coming
yes,
from?
Well, that's it's not clear where those rules come from the Gemara, right? The Gemara could be describing existing practice, when it says, Bahani Mili, not responding. And... I suppose part of what it is for me is that a place which isn't done in Marufia generally has chosen not to. And so if this is
no, that's only if it's not a Minhag Pesach.
Somebody still chose not to pass in that way. Yes. Okay. I will accept that you're less astonished from me, and I will be sure that when I have cases against somebody else that I recuse myself and bring it all to you because
also, he doesn't frame it as we're gonna pass it, right? He frames it as it's incumbent upon the tzibor who he serves.
Yeah, right.
to do this for him.
Right. So this is my formatting was designed to basically show you right, read the argument as there is an obligation to let a Talmid Chacham make a living, so you guys should let him make a living in this way. That's why I see it as creative, because I understand him as taking a general claim, right, that...
Why do you think there's any different than Nakti Leishukta?
That's crazy,
Nakti Leishukta. Nakti Leishukta is you, right, when he shows up with goods, you let him sell out. It doesn't...
That's crazy.
Yeah.
You close down the shop and let him sell out before
you
him.
Hand
that's
him a monopoly.
This.
It's the same thing. You hand him a monopoly.
This is even
no,
less.
This way he made his own monopoly and you're just not letting
it's not even a monopoly.
Not
it's
when
just
you're like,
people.
Does this person even know the answer to the Pil Shabbat Kipa Mitzris question?
Well, no one does
it. And I have to say, part of it underlying it for me is that we don't know how great Talmud Chacham is. All we know is that he doesn't inspire loyalty from his students.
Right. Or his students aren't very good. We have all sorts of stories of students being awful in the medieval period.
Yes. No, students,
most
you know,
students.
Regrettably, students aren't always worthy of their teachers.
The community likes him and he teaches them.
Pardon?
The community likes him and he teaches them.
I don't know. No. See, we have the Kahal, we have his Talmidim. I don't know if there's an intermediate. And there's the Rabbim, and we don't really know what the... Right. We don't really know what the difference is. He doesn't seem to me to be the world's most successful teacher. I guess that is the that's part of what bothers me. I guess is that I think that teachers of Torah should be judged to some extent on whether they instill character. And this doesn't seem to me to be a shining example. your students say, "Oh, look, Rebbe's making money. Let's go steal
it." Why
didn't
he teach them?
If he's the best in the city, if he's the best in the city, he's still the best in the city.
All right, he's the best the city has.
Which is why we need to bring someone else in.
Yes, right. Kenneth Sofrin would be a. Okay, I'm fine with all of you. Okay, now the version of this tshuva, we should be careful. Whenever you have a shiloh, you never know how many people the shiloh was sent to. Right, the males.
Was that a thing? When did the whole idea of only asking one person come in? People would send out their shiloh. Is it because you didn't know if they were?
It's always there, and at the same time, you don't know whether the males are going to get through, or the person's going to answer, right? So
is
I don't.
Is that just an excuse for shopping for?
I don't know. You know, I'm not a medieval historian.
There's the guy in the 60s with like six names. Yechezkel, Reuven, Shraga, something,
yeah.
Who has the same shiloh, you see him show up in every Tshuva Sefer written in the last generation. He's the exact same shiloh in the Igros Moshe, the Ibiya Omer, and Siliezer, Shlomo Zalman, Reuven Tzion Abishaul, and they're all from the same guy.
Well, if it's an abstraction, it doesn't apply to you. You can ask the question to anybody. Right, that's the Rav Shimon Bar Yochai asking the question, Darmel and Rabbi Yeshua. And there are people, right? Right, Gil Student just put on the web, right, that there's a whole set of questions about a whole bunch of issues, and he's the Otto Shoel to like five different people on all of them. Mark Shapiro likes sending questions to all sorts of Talmidei Chachamim and collecting the answers. So there are people, right? That's how they learn.
But he's a hobbyist. He's not asking serious questions.
Yes, he is.
Really? He's shopping for clues?
No, he's not shopping. He's collecting data for his scholarly work.
But also,
he's putting them on the record.
Do they know that, like, they're being
yes.
This wasn't written to Rabbi Gershon and the Maharam. They weren't alive at the same time.
Yeah. Yes, I don't know who any of these people are, okay? Right?
We know who the Maharam is.
Yeah, but who the people in the Tshuva are?
Reuven and Tshuva.
We'll get to Reuven right next tomorrow. Tomorrow we'll get to Reuven and Shimon, who have in their identity crisis.
The attribution to Rabbi Gershon comes from the Tefus Prag of Maharam. That's the only basis for it.
Okay.
So it's like we're basing ourselves on a printer that there are two Tshuva here.
Well, so here's my thing. If you look at the all I have is that if I look at the version of Shut Maharam, so you see that the question seems to be fundamentally identical. Right? It's really just typographical differences between the question. The first line of the Tshuva seems to be a typo in the version of the Shut Maharam Rotenberg, because it says Mitoch Shalachem Enu Nikar, and it seems much more plausible that it is Nikar. Right? Because that's what it sounds like. So it seems like the first version is correct. But okay. And then we go pretty much right all the way down until until the quote of Rabbi Yochanan, right? So we go through the same list of quotes, although the text of the Rabbi Yochanan statement is quoted differently, and then exactly where the previous tshuva goes into the answer and says we have to make a takana for this person, the version of the Shut Maharam Rotenberg has no notion of that, right? Yeah, all right. What, right? In the first tshuva, the version called Shut Rabbi Gershom, right? You go through the quote, you finish quoting all the things you have to do for the Talmidei Chachamim, and then we start. Mikola Talmidei Halalu, for all these reasons, they have to make a decree. But this one just says, right? Exactly at that point, switch it says Aval Matzasi, and he starts and he quotes. It just moves into a general claim about the importance of being done din marufya everywhere. And then it gets into a conversation about whether Rabbi Tam agrees with that or not. So the shaila is the same, right? But the answers are totally different.
Well, half the answers.
After
the same.
A point, yes, half the answer is the same, right? So that's.
Couldn't the Maharam just have this and like want to use it for something different?
Well, but he leaves out, right? He leaves out the part because, right? It has what seems to me is the most likely thing is that the tshuva called Rishut Rabbeinu Gershom Mer HaGola, right, with its answer, was appealed. Or the question, right, was sent somewhere else, and somebody substituted a different answer at the end. That would be, right, because the aval doesn't work very well.
I mean, unless you assume that until the aval, he's just quoting Rabbi Gershom.
So again, that's why we're speculating.
Right.
Right. Somebody at some point presents a very different answer to the same question. And we can't prove they were aware of each other. And furthermore, I think that if we read it, we'll see that actually probably there are three different answers. At least. Yes.
So we should go ask over collecting the Chuvos of Rabbi Gershom and ask where we got it from.
It'll be from some manuscript somewhere.
From the mom.
Sorry, whoever collects the Chuvos of Rabbi Gershom. Right, we should... he's in YU, we should go ask him.
He's not still in YU, I don't believe.
Is he still alive?
I don't. I
don't know. Pinchas Roth's PhD advisor, published a new Shoot Maharam.
Yeah.
So, like, email Pinchas Roth. That would be fine.
From Hebrew.
Email Pinchas Roth. That's fine.
He's also my friend's father.
Chef Professor Horvitz notes on his copy of
Rabbi. We don't know, right? You'll see, right? These, right? We're talking about.
Pinchas Roth will respond to my emails.
Yeah. So, email Pinchas Roth. Say, do you know anything about what happened with these Shuvah? I don't, you know, that's happy. Pinchas Roth is a nice guy. He seems like a good scholar.
It's fantastic.
I
don't understand why can't it just be he's looking at Rabbi Gershom's Shuvah. He has, like, some things to say, and it doesn't seem like he's answering anyone's question, so it's just some notes.
No. He
doesn't come to a conclusion, right?
Well, let's read through and see. Okay, so the first thing I want to get is that exactly where the other Shuvah gets to the conclusion that you all thought was perfectly reasonable and I thought was astonishing, this Shuvah cuts off.
Right.
Okay, yes, Ellie.
I'm just a stupid question, but does the Maharam Rutenberg live in a different business community that deals with Gaim differently than...
I don't know, nor do I have any idea that this Shuvah has ever been within 5,000 miles of the Maharam. Well, okay. Has ever been within 100 years of the Maharam Rutenberg. I don't know anything about it.
All I'm saying is that if the communities dealt with the Gaim and had different modes of commerce...
We don't know who any of these people are, so we can't say different modes of commerce.
We know who these people are.
Well, we don't know that the Shuvah is written by him. You have to stop buying into the words on top of the page.
You put them there.
So you can find it again. It's a reference.
I'm confused. So what does it mean? Can't believe it. I'm not sure.
Well, all that means is somebody went through lots of medieval manuscripts at the end, right? And you have a list of like 20 Shuvot. At the end of the 20th, it says May Rami Rutenberg, and he says, "Well, if the 20th is from Rami Rutenberg, why not the first 19?"
Yeah, that's a great assumption.
Are you saying that like we crowdsourced like? Each person wrote Shuvah and passed it on the
program. Yeah, people wrote. We don't know how people wrote things down. We don't know what they wrote. Copies were terrible. And all these collections, right? They're not one manuscript going consecutively. There's some editors putting things together from different manuscripts.
Like they never. Like I mean, a little bit more concretely, like no Rishon, almost no Rishon, wrote a Sefer of Shuvotim. Like they were collected of the answers put together by other people. So their construction.
And this is without getting into the Rembrandt Studio issue.
Or the Truth of Death.
What's the Rembrandt Studio issue?
But one thing is, because Rembrandt didn't paint everything himself.
No.
Right? So right, we try and you have the here. That's really Rembrandt. That's really Rembrandt Studio on the assumption that Rembrandt was really good. And his students were not so good. That's really the only grounds we have for the distinction.
So I'm just curious. Like, where did
wait,
the
so
line?
That says whenever something doesn't look
what
at
can
the
we,
line?
What can we
yes.
do?
We say it's not him.
So Piscala will say it's Rembrandt. If it doesn't, the brushwork doesn't look as good. Right? They will say it's Rembrandt's studio, and or they have some like Rembrandt drew the cartoon, but someone else did the paint by numbers.
What can we believe?
You can believe it's from somewhere in the vicinity, you know, probably from somewhere between the 10th and 12th centuries. Much of it.
Yeah, but the key with the Rembrandt studio, I think, is it's still Rembrandt.
No, it's not.
Well, it depends. If you see it as him setting out he says, here's my design, I'm going to do it, now have someone else.
Yeah, so I, right, so I said, right, so I
so
walked
I
in and I said, yesterday at Beitin, we had the following case, and I think the answer is roughly this, Jenna, go write the Shuvah.
What, that's what the Supreme Court does.
It's true.
So you don't say it's not just a skin.
So they have the same authority in the Supreme Court, on the assumption
right.
they read their own stuff.
I'm saying it's different than Rembrandt, where the artwork's actually different. As opposed to here, where if
the students write everything anyway.
If the Rashi approved the Psak, so the Rashi, it's still the Rashi Psak, he just might not.
Yeah.
I suppose. Some doubts about Thurgood Marshall. Who at the end, doesn't seem to have been quite.
I feel like Scalia is definitely writing his own stuff.
Scalia writes his own stuff.
No one's doing that for him.
I think. Although, I guess you should talk to. Moshe Spinoza, I think, is still in Brooklyn. He clerked for Scalia.
Oh,
so,
yeah. Is he a Jesuit?
No. It's true. All right. So here's the answer this time. Aval Matsasi. Okay, now this Matsasi means, right, this is whoever's writing this, and I think he's writing it in response, right, I think because of the Aval, he must be writing it in response to a different answer. And he's quoting, right? So Matsasi means I found a different tshuva. Right, so this is actually a reference to a different answer, right? A different shaila from somebody else entirely, right? Where the question was alotu maruf to Yisrael, and the answer was, ain't right? That's the headline is alotu maruf to Yisrael, and that other tshuva said, ain li Yisrael chaviro lefaisol l'shachto kedei lafkia miYisrael dichsiv, and then we quote the story of the Givonim, and it's yored l'chay chaverahu. And then we quote only Mahapech Becharora. And then we quote Rav Huna. Okay? And then we stop it at the lines. We stop it at the place where we say Rav Huna's legitimate call. So what happened is somebody took this question and appended to it, I think, a tshuva in a place where they, gosh darn, were done din marufya. And they did it on the grounds that it was a minag, but they did it on the grounds that was the halakha. And they did it because A, they paskin like Rav Huna, and B, they said that Rav Huna and the din of Ani Mahapech Becharora are the same, and Ani Mahapech Becharora is also prior restraint, and C, they had a really cool medrash, which turned right, and that cool medrash is about the category of Yored Umnas Chaveru, right? So this tshuva was a radical thing because it said right, it equated four things, right? It said we paskin like Rav Huna. Right, Rav Huna's din is the same as the moral din of Ani Mahapech Becharora, and right, both of these are an example of what the Medrash calls Yored, right, Yored L'chaye Chavercha, and Marufya is the perfect storm of all these things. Right, so this alternate answer says that really no, right, we have an absolute prohibition against interfering with someone's livelihood, which comes from all these things. And he comments, having quoted this, he says, "Me'elu harayos, from all these proofs that are quoted in that original tshuva of al oto marufya shel Yisrael, me'elu harayos nir ed asur." And then, either he or somebody else came along and said and quoted a Tosfot, and the Tosfot said, "Rabbi Netam omer denichsi agoy harei hein kehefker." Now we're really, really wild. Now this right, this alternate thing says, you know what? Right, we've stopped all the let us bracket all the details of the case of Nifsi Agoy Harehin Kemidbar. And all the things about the fancy star and the Kesef and all those sorts of things. You know what? Rabbi Tam said that there are no barriers on competition for non-Jewish assets. Right, Nifsi Agoy Harehin Kehefker means that there is no barrier to competition. Okay, kolakodim ben zacha. So be careful. It doesn't necessarily mean that, right, and I would prefer to think it doesn't mean, that any Jew can grab the assets of any non-Jew. What it means is, nichse agoy harehi kemidbar, the kolakodim ben zacha. Right, that the rule is that all restraints on competition in halacha are only when the competition is for Jewish assets. When the competition is for non-Jewish assets, all is fair.
Which makes sense, right?
Or actually, it makes sense.
The case in the Gemara would be crazy. If there's any case where you would have a restraint on what we'll call competition, right? It's the case where someone paid for something already and just hasn't picked it up as a king yet.
So it's a reasonable reading of the Gemara, right? Yesh is offering. Yesh is saying the case of the Gemara is so crazy, right? Where it's so obvious that there's a real relationship. That the only possible explanation for it is to say that we just say we withdraw from any attempt at regulating commerce between Jews and non-Jews. That's what that Gemara means. So we end up really as three completely different answers to this question. The first answer is, Marufya, it depends on place, but Talmidei Chacham get the advantages. The second answer is, Marufya, interfering with the Marufya is a terrible, terrible thing, tantamount to murder, right? Illegal, and you can get prior restraint to prevent it. And the third answer is, we never make any effort to regulate commerce between Jews and non-Jews. Period. And now that third answer, right? That third answer certainly just, right, is really wholly irrelevant to the, right. Really, the last two answers ignore the factor of the Talmud Chacham. The first tshuva cares about nothing, but this is the Talmud Chacham, protect him. The last two tshuvot don't really dwell, and that's because the last two tshuvot are really not addressing the case at all. Right? Really, it's a citation from a different tshuva and a citation from a Tosfot. Right, that I think is really the way to get out of it. So if you ask me, like, Psak, it might very well be that if I were called upon to paskin this, what I would say is, we have three different versions, but the last two don't really contradict the first, because the last two are really just people quoting halachic factors that relate to Din Marufya. The first tshuva agrees with the second answer. The first tshuva can agree with the Bina Talmud. There's no Din Marufya. But probably not. Probably not, because as many of you pointed out, what the first tshuva is really doing is saying there is a thing called Din Marufya, and we apply all existing benefits to a Talmid Chacham. So if you paskin like Rabbeinu Tam, who, as we frame it here, Rabbeinu Tam completely denies the Din Marufya, because Rabbeinu Tam believes that there cannot be any regulation of non-Jewish assets, so then probably the first tshuva rejects Rabbeinu Tam either, and we really have three different approaches. But the first one is the only one which really answered the question, so I would tend to say that in that case, I would have paskin like the first tshuva.
Except that it's quoted in the name of two different people who may or may not have written them 200 years prior.
I don't know who these people are. Some great Gaonim and Ashkenaz.
Maybe.
We can call it Maharam because that's an acronym. That increases your odds dramatically that you're quoting accurately. Right, how many people are there named Gershom? Oh, yeah, there was a hand. Yes, I mean.
Just in terms of your broad reading of Rabbeinu Tam as about all non-Jewish commerce, it doesn't really fit with the Peah case at all.
It doesn't really fit with the Peah case.
It doesn't have to, but it does leave that loose end.
No. That's at least because Rabbeinu Tam says, Rabbeinu Tam says it's all they're hefker. The question is, what does the word hefker mean? Those are the other proofs. Those are the other proofs that that Rabbeinu Tam holds that there is no barrier to conversation about hefker.
The issue is hefkerut, not the fact that they're not Jews.
Well, so Rabbeinu Tam says that non-Jewish assets are hefker. The question is, how seriously does he mean that? So you have three options. One is, it's just for this case. The other is, it's for all purposes of competition. And the third is that really no one owns them. So I'm trying to pick the middle ground. That it means, Nichsei Akim Hefker means that we treat assets of non-Jews the same way that we treat assets of Hefker for the purpose of competition. Rabbeinu Tam's Chiddush number one, which is that Hefker, there are no restraints on competition for Hefker. And the Chiddush number two, that the assets of non-Jews generally are like Hefker for this purpose.
Okay.
All right, that's my right. Because the reason they're Hefker is not because you didn't give the money yet, right? All right, so the only alternative would be to say that all assets of non-Jews are always Hefker, and that seems as a position I'd rather not take. Okay, yes, Ellie.
I'm just thinking that if Nechsei Akam Kimidbar, I wonder if that's if Yidden aren't hurt, but if there's a squabble amongst Yidden.
So the outcome is the same. Somebody gets the business.
But it's coming at the expense of another
Yidden. Yeah, so what? Wait, that's true of Hefker also. Yeah, that's what Rabbeinu Tam says, that two Jews can fight over Hefker.
It's inherently different.
Why is that worse than, like, let's say, Duncan?
I don't know, they haven't brought up fish at all.
Okay.
Rabbeinu Tam asked that, right? They asked that by Rabbeinu
Tam. Yeah.
Why differentiates fish from Peah?
In the Tosfos we do, right? So you can say mechanically, right, if you were trying to write it, you can have your checklist, you have your 10 cases, And any sheet that you find has to have its list of 10 cases, but you're already you know, lined up. You know that they're right because Tosfos asked these questions, so you know what the standard answers are to each of those cases. Fish are different because dage yave sira, so there's something special about fish.
Yeah, but here if it's marufia, then you know the guy is coming different business.
Yeah?
Like,
okay, you think it's like fish. We'll get there.
That's not what Tosfos says about fish.
But maybe it's because he put the effort in about fish.
Well, because there will be something that you take completely.
Yeah, right, or because he's starving, right, so there are all sorts of, or because he could spread his net somewhere else.
I mean, the dumb question is how does one, like, what kind of work and effort is needed to build a relationship?
Right, that's a fair question. How much work, we don't know the answer to these questions, right? So those are the right questions. We're going to do the work of Tosfos, and we're going to try it, and we can ask for each of these positions, what do you do with the other six cases you didn't quote? But they weren't quite as methodical as we were always. And they don't necessarily have all the toast food.
Also,
let's talk first. Yes.
How do we know that this Maram Gutenberg Tshuva isn't written by some or Baruch Asardi?
We don't! We do the best we can.
But that's the problem.
We do the best we can. Every once in a while, somebody puts out a sefer called Tshuvot HaRashba Miyuchasot LeRamban. Right? There's a collection, right? One of the lines of the Rashba's Tshuva is called the Rashba's Tshuvas that were previously called the Ramban, right? If you look at the Masada of...
Yosef Sykes and then Ramban.
Yes, if you look at the Masada of... Right, above Mitzia, right? So you have the Chiddush HaRitva and the Chiddush HaRitva HaChadashim, because we decided that the original Tshuvas HaRitva were really the Tshuvas Rimer Kirkusha, didn't we?
No, that's Gittin.
That's Gittin. Right, and the Chiddush HaRanan Sanhedrin is really Chiddush HaRibin HaDavid. People did the best they could.
Brachos, the Miri, and the Shita Gubetz, if those printed, are the same.
Okay, right, people?
Where is it? So, when you're reading this Tshuva, should you give it in Geneva?
Yes! It was almost certainly written by somebody of real significance in the Middle Ages in Germany.
Why do we assume that? Just because people have read it and not written
it? It is a Middag to treat it as if it was written by somebody of great significance, right? That might be a way of phrasing. It's a Middag to treat it as if it was written by the Brahmi Rambam.
Maybe it was written by a Moscow in the 18th century.
You know, it could be, what's his name? Berkovich, whatever.
Berkovich?
Friedland?
Saul J. Friedland.
Saul J. Friedland, right? So we have, you know, every once in a while forgeries make it in.
What?
There are two famous forgeries, one of which is non-controversial, which is the Yerushalmi Kudshim, and the other which is...
It's only non-controversial because it was caught almost immediately.
Yes, and the other one which is the Besamim Rosh, which is, well, you know, and then you have, you know, then Mark Shapiro has fun with the, right, with the Eshkol.
What does he say about the Eshkol?
There are two Eshkols, and he thinks that the volume published it.
Everyone knows the Orbach's forgery.
See, everyone knows, right?
Ravani says it in Shuva.
Sorry, so I'm saying this.
Ravani quotes the Samim Rosh.
Yeah, so I was just saying, everyone has these positions. I tend to be agnostic. I think that generally, you know, you work with the best that people tell you about it, the same way you work with the best that scientists tell you if you don't know anything about the field, and you work with the best that economists tell you if you don't know anything else about the field, but you do so with a lot of skepticism. Because many of these fields, the odds of they're on a good day, you know, like, I always love putting Robert Harlap's metaphor to me about creative Talmud scholars. He said Talmud Mechadshim are like baseball players. You know,
three out of ten,
you're really great, and even or one out of four if you have power. I said. And I think that's right. So they're great scholars. How often are they right? It could be. 250 with power is good. Same metaphor from the era, from the pre-steroid era. Right, so it's just once again true. Okay. I think that what, you know, that again, in general, halacha, right? So the position, the way positions get authority is that they survive multiple layers of winnowing. So The tshuva comes into circulation, and if people quote it, then it has more power.
So why do you put all the tshuvas we dig up in Bar-Ilan?
So part of the whole question, but then you can try and stick, and you know, the creative process. You can, right, if you find tshuva that are creative, you try and sneak them in. And we'll see, you know, then you know, and if people buy it, then it works. But it's always going to be some combination. You don't win by, right, if you find a Rishon who says, right, an alleged Rishon who says something really way out, so we know how to solve that. Right, we do the Rembrandt Studio thing. Right, which is, what do we call Rembrandt Studio?
Talmud Torah.
Talmud Torah Kasoka. Right, it was some erroneous student slipped this in when Rabbi Yehuda Gaon was blind and he couldn't see it. Right, but that happens nowadays, right? We're what's this called? Menashe Klein, right? He claims that about a tshuva Rav Moshe. Right, and lots of people claim that a certain tshuva of Rav Moshe that was really written, they were really written by Mordechai Tendler, and Rav Moshe was old already. And he didn't have the chance, right? He didn't have the chance to look them. So we pulled the Rembrandt Studio thing too.
But the Rembrandt Studio was not written in the 70s.
Nonetheless, we discovered it's probably true, right? It's probably true in many cases.
I'm saying we do that ourselves. We ignore everything Rabbi Asher said the last 10 years of his life because we assume people just made some up and put his name on it.
Only 10.
All the fit we have going on now all over the world, right? Where people come to me and say they have a Kabbalah from Rav so and so that nothing written in his name is his.
we have
discussion about the Rav and real, and they're real, right? So someone I trust very much told me that the Rav in the last years of his functioning life, when he was still giving shir, was incapable of standing up to pressure. So if people came in consecutively, if you stayed more than 5 minutes, he would agree with you. Because he couldn't stand up to pressure anymore psychologically. So often these things are true. I don't have any difficulty at all. And mostly we don't. Right, everything has to go through telephone. So there's some. The Gemara talks about it, right? There are the reliable tridents and the unreliable tridents. Right, some people come from yeshiva in Bavel, Teres Yisrael, and look, we want to find out what's going on in Bavel, so we listen to them. But we know that guy, if he says something a little strange, it's probably wrong. He probably didn't understand shir properly. Right, or he has an ideological bias. Right, all these things were true then, they're true now. I don't know. You know, if you ask me, what are the odds that this shiva is more real? There are always some things you know, right? You know, I don't believe Rav Henkin puts out anything that he doesn't really, really carefully.
Which Rav Henkin?
The current Rav Henkin. I think that he's very, very makpid, that everything that he comes out is mamish tachid yado, at the point, you know, and even, like, you know, so if you go through a Nishmat program, right, so they have to constantly check all their tshuva with him, because he's really, really makpid, that everything that comes out bishmo is really his. But not everyone else is. Sometimes students come back to me and quote things at me and say, oh my goodness, wow, I really didn't succeed in teaching that. But meanwhile, they've told their rebbeim, right? And then they're like, "Did you say that?" Sometimes they're right, and I did say it. I just didn't notice I was saying it. That's also true. Okay.
In general, the more something is quoted, the more authoritative it is.
On the whole,
rather than the more chashuv the name.
I think it's a balance of certainty. I think, you know, that, like, I think the Meiri is clearly the Meiri because no one else wrote that way. He has a distinctive style. And also, we only have one copy in most places. Other things, that's the Rabbeinu Tam we're looking at right now, right? So Rabbeinu Tam gets quoted by everybody, and so part of that means that that Rabbeinu Tam always gets distorted in some way. We have much more evidence. So it's much, right, whenever you have multiple voices, right, this is, in Perkei Avos, when it says, V'amidu Talmidim Harbe, right, it's always a choice, because, or the machlokas is all the way through history. If you want to preserve accuracy, your best bet is to have a narrow elite. Narrow elite is much less likely to make mistakes than a broad base, but a narrow mistake, all the mistakes a narrow elite make are perpetual, and there's no self-correcting mechanism. So you always have to choose about whether you're more willing to give up accurate, the chance of perfection, right? Or you're more right in order to avoid the risk of enormous error, or whether you're willing to say, you know what, right, if I can't get it perfect, there's no point doing it. Beis Ol B'Shama. Right? Beis Ol B'Shama is one, Rabbi Gamliel, Rabbi Zerben Azaria, right, all those, Anshe Knesset Agdola, right? That's why they say Amidah Tumanim Harbe, because they hit the point, right? That's at least what I argued, is that when you had Nevuah, so you had a different correcting mechanism.
Argument.
I don't think it's a chiddush, right? But when you lose Nevuah, then you say Amidah Tumanim Harbe, because right, because at that point you have no self-correcting mechanism, so you can't afford.
Sorry,
right?
Explain why Nevuah has more of a self-correcting.
No, Nevuah is the correcting mechanism for the tradition, because if you go off the rails, then Avi will get up and scream at you.
Right. Okay.
But when you lose Nevuah, the only right, you have no one outside to correct you anymore. Uh-huh. So now you need a broader base, so you don't right to correct right, to correct your errors. Okay, so then we have a shoot of the Rashba, probably. Seems promising.
Can you write out, like, next to every, when you put a citation, can you just write, like, a percent, like, your estimation of how long
it is? Should Rashba, Rashba, right?
I don't know anything about this.
Unless you heard it from the masters of Rashba.
Chelik Dalet, they found later as a manuscript, and that's why it's there's a lot of talk about it.
There are people who know vastly more about this than I do, and there are many, many of them. I would think, you know, I probably fit in the bottom 20%.
Moshe Kapel did a cool thing where he, like, did the computer study.
Yes.
Well, I mean, the upshot of that is you find massive self-consistency within most of the Rashba, most of the Rifa, and most of the Ramban, and then you can use that consistency to classify unknown tissue of unknown origin.
Yes, then we get right into religious issues, because we know what he's working on, what he's trying to do with it.
We do.
So you have to figure out how much credence you want to give to that. He would like to find J, E, P, and D.
Yeah,
By linguistic phenomena. So,
no, but also he's very... I would totally trust
it him. Supposedly worked in Shakespeare. But, you know, but again, how do you prove it? I don't know. I think it's better than Torah codes.
is that your bar?
That is pain, your pained praise indeed. It's not fraudulent, the best as best I can tell. Yes?
I've been like dominating the scene for too long, but I'm gonna like just try one more question.
Yes.
So let's say you have like a manuscript, a tshuva, that says something, right? So the visu, and no one else covers.
Okay, Violet. So, the Rashba in Lourdes has a question about Reuven, who is a tailor who has an exclusive. And now Shimon comes along, and he wishes very straightforwardly to compete on price with Reuven. And now Reuven is suing him, and he has a list of things. Is he mazik b'yadayim, in which case he can sue for damages? Grama ben Ezekiel, which is more problematic. Ani b'hafei b'charara, right? Moral, where is Usur? Then he can on the claim. What's the answer? So the answer is a completely different approach to everything. There's the chol kiha, ein bezin motziim yado she'akum bal hamalacha natan lo midato. So he says the reason that you can't sue is because the other person gave him the money out of his own head, out of his own intention. Now that's not the problem. Of course he came out of his own intention, but you got to do it.
Right.
I'm suing you for the other person. But his principle is, look, non-Jews are free people. And you can't be responsible for what they did in quite the same way. Yes, Elliot?
We saw this exact concept in the Shibur of the Gaonim.
Yeah.
Imi dat amokwa with the anime effect. You can't get back.
Yeah, so you're right. That is right. Very good. Right. This seems to be right an echo of that position, right, of that position in the Gaonim, that is, fundamentally, it's a free will transaction. So, in terms of law, all law asks, right, all right, you can't ever claim that somebody's responsible for someone else's decision. Yes, Jenna?
So then he's saying no demars ever.
So then he's saying no formal, right, well...
No post facto.
No post facto, right, doesn't tell you about prior restraints. Right, it just tells you that you can't sue for damages afterwards.
I feel like that's what we've been kind of asking from the beginning, is you have to show damages first to keep restraints and one from the beginning.
No, but Elias are in the verse. There are cases where you can restrain somebody.
Yeah.
But if they went against it, you can't claim damages.
Right. Have we seen, where have we seen someone actually being able to go to the Beit Din and restrain someone ahead of time?
Well, we just saw in the last case where they restrained him for the Talmid Chacham.
Okay. That's because it was already there.
And he restrained them from competing. Right, that's
okay.
That's what Rav Huna says, right?
No, but am I wrong? Have we not been asking him, like, do you have to prove damages, or can you say you're going to infringe on my life?
So any case which talks about prior restraint, so we talked about in Babavastra whether you could prove that whether you had to show that there had been damages in order to restrain them from going forward. But we didn't, right? But we certainly had a distinction between saying you can't do it and saying once you did it, you have to pay me.
Yeah.
Right. That we've had all the way through. Yes, Supreme.
Yeah, but this is just a logical extension of all the store cases where once you set it up, you can't lose it to people. And in this case, he just says that customers have free will, so we're not.
Right, but then he says, even though there is no possibility in law of suing for damages, but mochin biado, but we can object to somebody doing it. Now, what force we can object it to? He hasn't gotten that yet. Ready? He hasn't. He hasn't gotten that far. And then he says, "Hang on a sec." But first he says, "There's no possibility of restitution in court, because ultimately the non-Jew made up his own." His own decision. Then he says, but we paskin against Rav Huna. No, but this is different because even if we paskin against Rav Huna, we still paskin like the fish case. And that's really the whole rest of his argument is trying to find some way to frame the fish case in some kind of legal category, and he has all sorts of terms. Right? He has Vikarov Hulanotel Minus Charo. Afapishin Otel Mamash, right? He has Kiyohiv Dato Alze, Kiilu Bali Ado, right? So he has a whole list of things. The upshot of which is that he's trying to construct a moral category, but he thinks that there is no formal legal category. Yes, Eli.
I wonder if the problem is a problem for this, because. In that case, we don't care who the guy sold to willingly.
Yeah.
So was that relevant? So why is here? I mean, his Baal Malacha is not relevant there.
So he doesn't. This tshuva, the Rashba, doesn't work off the basis Nichsei of the Kochav Marin Kehefker. It's a different idea.
But over there, you could have argued to say that. The guy who was selling, but there,
we're not talking about right when you end up stealing it. In that case, you don't steal it because you're not stealing the goy's business. You're stealing land directly. All right, so that we don't care whether right. We know that Andrew was trying to give it to the other guy. We're not trying to say he shouldn't be allowed to change his mind. Right, you didn't change his mind. You just snuck in. All right, so it's not. I don't think the case is relevant at all. Okay, so then we get to the Orzeru.
Wait, but sorry.
Yes.
What is
We yell and scream at him.
Like, that's it?
Well, that's what we have to figure out. It might mean we call him a Russia.
Okay.
Now, what does that mean? So it can be anything.
No, but it might mean that
you can't
stop him. It might be you prevent further action.
It might.
I would also be pretty scared if someone yelled and screamed at me. Like, it's not like it's not
a hell. So part of the issue is that... so
not as many people
let's start it this way. Let's start... Let's take as the basic premise of halacha is that rabbis can do whatever they want.
Seems like.
Right? It's not whether the rabbinic will is a halachic way. It's the rabbinic will is the halacha. And that the whole effort of rabbis is to control their power. Right? That's the converse.
He specifically reads the case of marchikim.
Yeah.
As your me'akev, the dayan. And he says the thing about
so far away.
Dina who de lo ma'akev mipnei shiachol lomar lo atav sabtov shalchav and yosef tov shali.
Yeah.
Mode the mitzvah tadag. The other person is, the other sheet in the Gemara is mode that in the case of mitzvah tadag that you are ma'akev.
But he says it's not really legamre. Right? It's not legamre like it. Right? Right? So I think he's still in this... But I think what we have to get is, and we'll, I think we'll, if we haven't seen it explicitly, we'll see it already, that really they're living in a world where rabbis can't legislate. So if something seems really problematic and is morally wrong, the rabbis will just say, okay, this is one of the cases where we will legislate our moral thing. But they don't want to, because they don't want to have the impression that they're ruling by fiat, and they don't trust their own power. Right? So the rabbis will try very hard to restrain their power and to say, no, here all we can do is... But if it turns out it's not working, then they'll legislate. So I think it's very risky to draw very, very strong precedents from Truvot. What you learn from Truvot is that this is a case where the rabbis would rather not exercise power if they don't have to. Yes, Elliot?
So I guess you said when you said you don't want to have precedent, but what happens today when the rabbis don't have any?
Right, that is a big issue right now. So nowadays, if we admit it's not the right, if we admit it's not the law already, we have no power at all.
That's why I would disagree. I think the only power that rabbis have today is to say is to get up and shout and say and announce that people are bad people.
So we have two different things, right? On the one hand, the only power rabbis have no enforcement power. On the other hand, nobody recognizes rabbis' powers to make statements other than the halakha. So you have to do right. You have to say, this is the halakha, and I'm yelling at you because you're violating the halakha. Not I'm yelling at you because you did something wrong. Because if you say I'm yelling at you did something wrong, people look at you and say, well, it's not halachic. Why does your judgment take precedence?
I disagree with that.
Uh-huh.
I think that's a response that comes up a lot.
No,
just because
the rabbi has absolute power.
Pulpit. It's like in the way that in Ashkenaz, everybody used to be able to get up and stand still. The rabbi could get up in the pulpit and call someone out. They would never would, but they could.
So I think this is a great conversation we should have at a meal. about the extent to which people are willing to give rabbis moral authority beyond the halachic nowadays, and may very well vary by community.
Yes, for sure.
Right.
And I mean, like in the U.S., it's different than in Israel, and to certainly denominationally. I mean, that's what a rabbi is in like let's say the Reform community.
Well, it doesn't help if he says halacha. It's the only authority he's going to
have.
Exactly.
No, so if a rabbi has any authority, it's only in that.
Yeah, so that is really an interesting phenomenon. What authority rabbis. So I think my sense is in the Orthodox community, moral statements by rabbis don't carry anywhere near as much weight as halachic statements. And the admission, this is not halacha, but everyone starts rebelling, so it's not halacha. So what is right? So then you should have an equal part in the conversation, which I think is deeply problematic. At the same time, I also don't trust rabbis more than you do. So that is it, right? So how you balance that, I think, is a really big challenge. All I'm just saying, reading Truvot, is I think that the statement that something is not the law as such means often in a medieval Truva, and therefore we have to decide what we want to do, as opposed to this is what we have to do.
The rabbis were saying that.
Yeah.
But back then, were rabbis looked at as moral leaders?
I hope so. They looked at themselves as moral leaders, it seems to be, pretty much. And that's part of, a big part of it is just confidence. Right? That's a big part of it, having the confidence to believe. Or willing to take chances that they'll run you out of town. Because when you try and exercise moral leadership, people will often run you out of town. It's true. Especially if you try to exercise moral leadership against the wealthy.
Oh, yeah.
Right? So. I think that's...
Like Robin Hood,
no, it's just reality, right? Reality is that you have a certain amount of power and other people have a certain amount of power, and if you put yourself against theirs, you're going to lose sometimes.
It's not just moral authority, though. I think that applies just as equally to halakhic authority. If you're going against the wrong people halakhically, you're also going
to
get...
Yeah, although less, only to the extent if you can convince people that really is the halakha, right? It's only, right, the issue is what... Now we have the modern, what if there are options halakhically, right, and you're choosing among them? So what gives you the authority to choose?
More credit to the masses than
the maybe. Okay. Okay. So much. So we're back in the Arzarua. So the Arzarua begins by talking about, he says, the case of Marufia. And he begins by saying that Marufia is absolutely a din. All right? He doesn't say anything about Minag, right? These halvos, and a Jew has a Marufia, no other Jew can try to seduce the Marufia away, because you know what? There are lots of non-Jews. Every Jew can have a non-Jew for themselves, because you know what? The relation between Jews and non-Jews in the world is a greater than 1-to-1 correspondence. There are more non-Jews than Jews. There are probably even more non-Jews with assets than there are Jews. So competition in the Jewish community is unnecessary. So that's the opening tshuva is just flat out. A marufia is just a straight out case where you of ani mahapik becharor. Although he doesn't use that term. But now he goes further. He says, V'chein matzasi v'shem Shmuel ben Rabbi Meir zatzal d'asur. I found the Rashbam said that this case, Marufi is completely asur. And he wrote, this is just like Rav Huna. And it's also like the dog, right? So we have two ways that we can claim that we paskin like Rav Huna, and even if we don't paskin like Rav Huna, we can say it's like the fish. So right now, Marufi is a straight out halacha. It's just asur. You cannot interfere with the Marufi. Yes?
How do they keep doing this? Saying
that Rav
Huna and the fish case are similar. Like the Gemara?
Okay, I doesn't think so. Well, the Gemara says you can't prove Rav Huna from the fish case. But at the end of the day, you might say, okay, you can't prove it. But there's a lot of similarity.
It's the same kind of Kapasakto.
But then we go, he says, Uvashem Rabbeinu Tam Zatzal Matsasi Deshari. He says, even though he found this true for Rashbam, who said it's Asra Lagamre, but he found Rabbeinu Tam said this is completely mutter. Why did Rabbeinu Tam say this? The Kaimilam Becheskes Habatim, the Nichse Ha'akum Harehen Kehefker. And he goes on and quotes it, Alma Nichse Ha'akum Hefkerin. So he quotes the version of Rabbeinu Tam that we found at the end of the Shut Maharam, right, which says that you cannot have a din, right? So here again, We're not talking about any special decrees of Marufia. We're not talking about local minhagim. Here we have a flat-out machlokas. Is there a din Marufia or not? The Rashbam says yes. And Rabbeinu Tam is quoted as saying, there cannot be a din Marufia. And nobody considers the possibility of legislating a din Marufia. Rabbeinu Tam says, how could there possibly be any restraint on competition for non-Jews? Yes, Yaakov.
Should we read anything?
That's ke'ilu hay nichse ager, right? That's the class. Nichse ager really are hefker. Nichse ager, right? Nichse ager shemes are really are hefker.
Right. So it's nichse ager shemes without any Jewish hirsch.
Yes.
Okay.
But now the author of this shavu, right, the Or Zeruah, says the ein nira ben hay klal. But I think Rabbeinu Tam is completely wrong. Right, fighting words.
Right.
Yeah, this I think the Arzuru actually is a book. It's a multi-generation. You know, I think it's a sort of multi-generational book, isn't it?
The school, the
right.
The Arzuru is we know who it is. Someone Arzuru. Time's
father. Yes.
Yitzhak Arzuru.
Yitzhak Arzuru.
Yeah.
And did he write it himself entirely?
I think so.
I don't know.
It was the Marav. The son.
He was the Tommy of the Rabbi.
The time of the Rav, yeah. Okay.
That makes sense.
So now we're back in the... Okay. okay, so what he says is, Eini relei klal, v'afal gav dehefkerhein, v'im hechazik behem zacha, mikol makom l'chatchila ein lo la'asos, v'yavid nikra rasha. Ki perish Rabbeinu Shmuel zatzal hasam. So he says that there's a machlokas Rashbam Rabbeinu Tam about Marufia, and... There's a machlokas Rashbam Rabbeinu Tam in the case of Nichse Akum Harei and Kehefker, where the Rabbeinu Tam says it's completely mutter, and Rashbam says that you're still a Rasha. Right, so he thinks that he goes like Rashbam in both. You're a Rasha in the case in the Gemara, and in general, there simply is an Isser Din Marufia. And then he makes a claim that I think is pushing it a little bit. Right, he says Vesu, v'divrei Rabbeinu Tam zikrono levracha gufei. He thinks that the citation he just had of Tom still says it's asur. The afagav the nitzia goy harein kehefker mikol makom harehu dami the mesuda sadag. The afagav the hefkerin mikol makom afilu hachi marchikin mesuda. Now we're in the world, we're in the earth. In Rabbeinu Tam's words, did he say anything about this? About fish. So you see, friend. I'm not here. Right. So it seems like he's working with an implicit argument that Rabbeinu Tam, when he says that you're allowed to compete about Hefker, he still has to deal with the case of Mesudas Hadag, and he thinks that this case will be like Mesudas Hadag even according to Ibn Hatam. His language is stronger than that, right? Midivrei Ibn Hatam Gufei. So maybe he has a version of Tosfot which Ibn Hatam himself gives the answer to the fish case, and he just neglects to quote it, which is unfortunate. Okay, so going through our options. So we have the person who says that Marufia is purely local. We make it Ritamina Chachamim. The person who says that there's no possibility of a Din Marufia. The person who says there absolutely is a Din Marufia. And here it's not quite clear. He seems to suggest, well, either there's Marufia as an actionable offense or Marufia as a moral offense. Okay, in the Mordechai you get the same position, name of the Arzaruah, but he just adds in one line that matters to us, which he claims that the Chain Hora Ri Bishmo Le'esor. So now we have reports that not only does it seem from Ibn Hatam as if he's correct, but we even have a claim that the Ri paskin that way in the name of Ibn Hatam. So we've supported it, right? We support it with a stronger tradition. Unfortunately, the Arzaruah we have doesn't record that at all. Okay, then we have the Mordechai, Remez Tav Kuf Chaf Dalet, and the Mordechai in Remez Tav Kuf Chaf Dalet introduces a totally different way of looking at the case. He says, you know why? He says that case of Nichsi Agoy Harehim Kehefker is not at all relevant. The reason for that case, the reason that I held it was Mutter in that case, is not because Nichsi Akum Harehim Kehefker, but rather because... No. In Remez Tav Kuf Chaf Dalet, what does the Mordechai say? What's right? Why is it okay to take the land in that case? No, that's not why it's okay. Why is it okay? Because we're in.
Oh,
Yehud Afsir Nafshe. Yeah, in Tav Kuf Chaf Dalet, last line. Mi Rabbi Natan Pirish, the Yehud Afsir Nafshe. Rabbi Natan says that you can take advantage of idiots. As a Jew, you know the halacha. The halacha is once you give the money, if you haven't gotten the shtar, then the land is ownerless. So you shouldn't be an idiot. You should get the shtar before you give the money. All right, Rabbi Natan is kind of in a Darwinian economics here. Anybody who's dumb enough to create a circumstance like this deserves to lose the money. But if this is true, then this is completely opposed to everything we've written in Rabbi Natan's name so far. Yes, Avi.
Well, not quite.
If we really say it comes down to a shtar,
yeah.
Doesn't the difference between Jews and non-Jews dissolve when we get to the Talmud?
Yeah. And this, if this version of Ibn Hatam is correct, here is my claim. This version of Ibn Hatam is correct. Ibn Hatam says nothing whatever about assets of non-Jews being like Hefker. Mm-hmm. What he says is, generally, it's permitted to compete in Hefker. And this case, where the Gemara says you can compete, is a special case unrelated to Hefker.
Well, no, this is answering the Arzaruah, right?
He's answering...
I mean, the Arzaruah agrees, Rabbi Natan says usually you compete in Hefker. It's never going to be anyhow ha-charara.
Yeah.
However, we have a case where Rabbi Natan has to make a chiluk, because we have this...
That's fish.
Right. So the point is here, even if this case will be similar to a fish case for whatever reason the Arzaruah thought it could be... The point is, since the guy's a moron, it's fine. Because being a moron overrides whatever makes this similar to...
That's right, but once being a moron overrides, you don't need it being Hefker anymore.
Well, no, because that's the original principle that lets you make the Kenyan on in the first place.
Yeah, it has to not be owned by somebody else. But it's not because of some principle in Nichse Akum or Yenke Hefker. No. These assets are Hefker.
Nichse Akum, that you received this...
In this very narrow case, right?
Yeah.
But the previous Shuva, quoted Rabbi Natan, is making this broad principle that there's no competition for non-Jewish, right? There's no ban on competition for non-Jewish money.
Right.
Now, if I were engaged in highly speculative historical reconstruction, what I would say is, right, we have two positions of Rabbi Natan that are known. One position of Rabbi Natan is that there's no ban on competition for Hefker. A second position of Rabbi Natan is that it's perfectly okay in the case of Nitzei Akum Arayin Kemidbar, to set, right, to compete. And then, somebody put those two positions together, but they may not have been related at all. Right, it may have been there, right, the I'm not sure that that I'm comfortable attributing the position, that right, the intermediate position, which on the other hand doesn't really have a deep conceptual background, that there's no competition among Jews for non-Jewish money, because to me it seems quite no ban on competition for Jews for non-Jewish money, because to me it seems that the argument should go the other way around. The economic interest of the community is to allow Jews to compete for Jewish money, and not to allow them to compete for non-Jewish money with each other, because that's inefficient. So, if I had to guess, I would say, that that this narrower position, Rabbi Natan's position, is the correct one, but that is sheer speculation, which I think has just about no halachic weight. It's just interesting historical speculation.
I mean, our setup still works, right? It still could work. Because Rabbi Natan does hold open competition on everything hefker.
Yeah.
Right? And Rabbi Natan, so in theory, so any hefker case that's not similar to the fish, he's going to hold open competition on. And we do have a rule here. We do have a case where this crazy case where you can take something from a guy when he did his kinyan with a guy. So as long as you have a case which involves a non-Jew, which isn't similar to a fish case, so Rabbi Natan still stands up.
Possible.
We need to figure out what the similarity of the fish case is and what's going to follow from that spectrum.
Yeah. Okay. The next Mordechai, all I was interested in was pointing out was, first of all, somebody put the words Nitzei Avodei Kochavim Anas. How you have to go. I don't know where that Anas came from.
Oh, in the last one.
Okay.
On the Nitzei Avodei Kochavim, he's a bully who just wants his money quickly. So.
Okay. Fine. Very good. And then I don't know who the Rabbi Loi in question is, or who the Rabbi Abba and Rabbi Loi are, the Chalar Batei and Shavim Medavar. They don't sound like medieval names, they sound like Talmudic names.
Right.
And I don't know who they are. So that's also a challenge. But it seems to be that you have here, there seems to be a tradition in the school of Maram that Marufya is a local halacha, and on the other hand, people saying, but you know, it depends on the fish. So all the rest of the Makorot, what I just did was, so when you get post-medieval, so then people keep on being deeply resistant to the notion that the question of whether you're Dan Marufya is a legislative question. Right? So my argument is, if you read the Shut Maral, the Shut Benegesha Maragola, it sounds like Marufya is a legislative question. Should we do this or should we not do this? It occurs right after we know what the Din of the Gemara is. And the Chora, the Din of the Gemara is that whatever restraints we have in competition don't apply to the Marufya case. Most likely because it's complete, because Rabbi Tam is in a sense right, that their Marufya is not a geographic location. Right? The Marufya can be somebody, right? The Marufya people are completely outside of town, right? They're in a non-Jewish section. So, and then the question was, we had a viable question in the Jewish community. We're all engaged in money lending. Wouldn't it be much more efficient if we said that once you land your fish, then everybody else should go fishing somewhere else? But once you get out of the medieval period, nobody's willing to do that. So right. So I gave you the whole set of people, starting with the Beis Yosef, going to the Gra, going to early 20th century people, to contemporaries, and each one of them will tell you that the machloket, whether you're done din marufi or not, depends on a different machloket in the Gemara. It depends whether you hold like Rav Huna or Rav Huna Brinner of Yeshua. It depends like you hold like Rabbi Tam's understanding of the fish case or the Rashbam's understanding of the fish case. It depends whether you hold like Rav Shimon Gamliel or Rabbanan. It depends on whether everyone feels compelled to connect the Marufya case and make it a legal dispute, make it a minhag hapsak issue, as opposed to a minhag issue. So I want to put on the table that my suspicion is historically that this is incorrect. That really, in fact, the question was whether you're done din marufia or not was a legislative question. It might be that we could bridge the difference by saying that everyone understood that marufia was a case of ayin hafek becharara, but that they held ayin hafek becharara is not a case in which you can go to court over it. So that's the moral case. So the machloket was, whether this was one of the circumstances in which it was wise to it was wise to enforce it as law, even though fundamentally there was only a it was only a moral distinction. Right? So that seems to me to be a very possible reading. And now what I want to just do is, you know, thinking through your own head, is to realize how all the positions of Rabbeinu Tam will interconnect with each other. Because what do we know about Rabbeinu Tam? Rabbeinu Tam has a position about whether this competition is bad hefker. That opens up the possibility of explaining the case, right, explaining the case of non-Jew, right, Nifsei Akam Rehin Kimidbar, as being just about hefker. Right, and that, right, on the other hand, Rabbeinu Tam also takes the position that to be called a Rasha, we saw it, for at least to some people, to be called a Rasha, right, means that you can actually sue in court, which means that he doesn't have space for the distinction between moral, right, between Anim HaPech B'Charara and enforceability, right? Because he thinks that anything where the case of Anim HaPech B'Charara is enforceable, right? So all those positions of Rabbeinu Tam are going to interconnect, and if you only have some of them, then you will construct him differently. Right, so I think that's why I think it's really a valuable exercise to try and figure out when we're done, right? What do we really know about Rabbeinu Tam? Because I think that all his positions interconnect, but I also think that you can't trust all the positions attributed to him, because some of them are what the Gemara says, right? That Gemara, right? One Amora asks another often, right, was that what you just said, was that Beferusha Itmar or Michlalo Itmar? Right? Did you hear that from him directly, or did you figure out that was what he meant? Because you said that, right, that was derived from his position. So I think that some of the positions we have in the Shem Rabbeinu Tam are Michlalo Itmar. Somebody saw a bunch of Rabbeinu Tam's positions and they did their own construction. And I don't know which of them it is. Now the other question we should ask is, now we are now, I guess, right, so with the exception, we're going to do the Marik tomorrow. And the Marik really only has one idea that matters to us. And with that, we're out of the Middle Ages. So the fair question is, what do we know coming out of the Middle Ages, right? So what do we have halakhically as a reasonable basis? So
we don't have the Marshal.
Marshal is 16th century.
Oh, okay.
Right, for me, right, the Marshal is the transition figure, because from my perspective, the Middle Ages end with the Beis Yosef, because the Beis Yosef stops trying to be it. Because I think ages end when you start writing super commentaries instead of commentaries. So the Beis Yosef is the first figure who really sees his job as anthologizing precedent, as opposed to contributing a whole new line. So the Middle Ages basically ended the Beis Yosef. The Marshal is an interesting figure because while he lives afterwards, he doesn't accept the synthesizing campaign of the Shulchan Aruch. So he writes as if the Shulchan Aruch never happened, which Meichel Versa tells me, Rav Kellmer said, is how you have to understand the Rav's Pesach. The Shulchan Aruch never happened. Right, the fact that something that the Shulchan Aruch happened doesn't mean that options that he doesn't quote don't make it into halacha. But we are out of the Middle Ages, and so it's worth trying to figure out what we have coming out of the Middle Ages. What we have, as usually, is a mess. Almost every possible option exists. You can pass in like Rav Huna, you can pass in against Rav Huna, or you can pass in against Rav Huna, but claim that we're motivated to him in all the cases that matters.
Right? We have this thing about lo kachim and lo kachim.
Pardon?
We have this thing about lo kachim and lo kachim.
Yeah, that's right. We have protectionists, we have mercantilists. We have a claim that competition doesn't matter. Right? There's no restrictions on competition outside the Jewish community, and then you have what I think is a much more sensible position that we are more interested in restricting competition when it's for money outside the Jewish community, because we gain nothing by preventing competition. So now what we're going to do is we'll do the Marshal, but the way the Marshal is going to be set up. Just, so I talked about how you read the Tshuva both ways, but the way I set up the Mekorot, so at the end of tomorrow's Mekorot, you should have read the question that he addresses. Right, he's doing a tshuva, so you'll have read his question, and I think a useful exercise to try and figure out what do you think the right answer to his tshuva is, because you have access to everything he had.
We're not even sure which is the correct manuscript. So
for the question, it won't make so much difference, although you'll see the Reuven instrument will drive you nuts for a little bit. You'll see.
So you're saying you're not getting us the answer, you're just giving us the answer.
So then the next day, Wednesday, we'll read his answer. But I think that it's worth, right, as an exercise, so right, when we finish the question, right, that's perhaps what we'll try and do at the, in the, in as it's part of Shear, is to say, okay, so here is the question. We have access to all the information that he had and more. What do we think the right answer to this question is and why? And then we'll have another week or so to cover the next 500 years. And then we'll ask the same, you know, we'll ask a variant of the same question and say, what should halacha be now? But I'd say up front, looking at it now, you'll have had much more direct exposure to the first 500 years than the next 500 years. So that's, so much of the next 500 years you're going to have to get from reading through the secondary sources and just seeing what, right, what in the current world, right, what people possibly like nowadays, and then deciding, because we're not going to have time to read every, or even any, probably, of the immediate, late, let's say, of this material from 1980 to 2015. Okay. Thank you. Yes, Ellie.
A lot of the modern ones we saw today did talk about Hataka. Is that cool? Was that, you know, do you think it was,
yeah,
not a lot of cut very small, but are we going to get to see, like, where the
So the hope
seems
is,
like, it's, in order to actually be in conversation with the